All right, so we are beginning Shoftim Perek Tes, Chapter 9. We introduced it briefly at the end of last week, and we said that we're moving into Avimelech. Avimelech is, in a sense, the anti-Gideon. He's, of course, Gideon's son, but he's the anti-Gideon. He is, in certain ways, the outgrowth of what we talked about as the Midianite influence, where there is strife, where there is idolatry, there is immorality. The story of Avimelech, interestingly, does not involve any non-Jewish enemy. Right? Whereas we had Midian as an enemy, and we had Canaan as an enemy, and we had Moab as an enemy, Plishtim we'll be seeing later on. Here, the enemy, as the line goes, is us. There are non-Jews potentially involved, depending on how we understand the population of Shechem. We'll have to talk about that. But basically, we are the good guys and we are the bad guys. And we also see here a little bit, and that'll be today, about the role of a leader and the pursuit of power. Last time I read for you, and so I didn't reproduce it on the sheets here, Abarbanel's introduction to Shoftim, where he says that all the Shoftim are righteous. The Shoftim are all good. And as far as Avimelech, well, he killed people before he became a Shofet. It is unclear to me what makes Avimelech a Shofet. We don't have God selecting him in any way that's visible in the book. He campaigns for it by killing the competition, which, you know, is one way. Radak, in fact, is going to seem to say that he is not a Shofet. It'll be on Perek Tet Pasuk Chav Bet, 922. But then on the other hand, in the beginning of chapter 10, he's going to say that he is a Shofet. In the sense that he's not a Shofet, in the sense that he's not judging anybody. When we think of a Shofet meaning judge, he doesn't do that. At the same time, he will, according to Radak, fight wars to save us from our enemies. Where are those wars? Not in our text. The text will not present him doing anything on our behalf whatsoever besides, you know, killing members of the Jewish people. So it's going to be a fun ride. That's really what I'm trying to say. So the story begins in a very bloody way. Take a look at Perek Tet, chapter 9. We'll do the opening five psukim, which is really the beginning of this story. Vayelech Avimelech ben Yerubal Shechema el Achei Imo. Avimelech, son of Yerubal, goes to Shechem, to his maternal brothers. Remember we said last time that, not maternal brothers, maternal uncles, right? Achei Imo, his mother's brothers. We said last time that he is the son of a Pelegesh. Gideon has 70 sons via his wives, and he has a concubine, and Avimelech is the product of the concubine. So he goes to the concubine's brothers. We do not know at this stage. We cannot determine Jewish or non-Jewish. It's not clear. And he said to them, and he said to the family of the house of his grandfather, his mother's father, the following. Speak on my behalf, he says to the family. Speak to all of the masters of Shechem. The Dot Mikra edition here, Professor Elitzur, says Ezrachei Shechem, the citizens of Shechem, the landowners of Shechem. Ma tov lachem, what do you prefer? Ha mishol bachem shivim ish, kol b'nei Yerubal. Im mishol bachem ish achad, would you rather be ruled by 70 men, the sons of Yerubal, suggesting, as we said last time, that Gideon had designed that group as a leadership group. He wanted them to be a network of leaders. You prefer them, or just one man? And remember, I am your, literally, bone and your flesh. So they did it. His uncles went to the people who are the citizens or leaders of Shechem, tell them all of this. He's called, and they said, you know, he's our brother. We should side with him. Because this is campaigning, right? Campaigning involves fundraising. So they give him 70 silver coins from Baal Brit. Baal Brit is one of the Baalim, which are Avodah Zarah. Vayiskor bahem Avimelech anashim reikim ufochazim. So what do you do when you raise money and you have a campaign war chest? You get campaign staff. So he hires men who are reikim upochazim. Reikim means what?
Empty.
Pochez? Hasty. Faultless. Right? Remember Yaakov's statement about Reuven, Pachaz Kamayim? The people who act in reckless ways. And they followed him. Vayavo beis aviv ofrasa. And they came to the house of his father in Ofrat. Vayaro gezechav. And they killed his brothers, Bnei Yerubal, the sons of Yerubal, Shivim ish, Halevan achas, 70 men on one stone. Vayivaser Yosam ben Yerubal hakaton ki nechba. Only one of them escapes. The youngest one, Yotam, hides. That's your story. So there's a lot here that's interesting. What bothers you? What do you take notice of here?
He's not Ben Gidon anymore.
He's not Ben Gidon, right. We've switched over to be Yerubal exclusively. We noted that at the end of the previous parak that here we're going to switch over exclusively to call him Yerubal. Good. What else? Nothing else? I mean, I can think of a few things here.
Why was it so easy to kill 70? You just hire a few people.
Yeah. And clearly no one's expecting an attack. But what's interesting, maybe this is what you're pointing to, is they're all in one place. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you had 70 of them. What are the odds?
Well, if you're saying that he was trying to make a Sanhedrin take concept.
I didn't say Sanhedrin. But yes, some kind of leadership network. Then maybe yes, this was something political.
Why is he killing them to begin with? What's the
Well, you know why he's killing them.
But to show power, and he's, I can do anything.
Not to show power, to consolidate power.
I mean,
he's just gotten rid of the competition.
Yeah, I mean, we use the term show faith, but it's like being a king. Gideon was like a king. He wants to be like a king over Israel.
Right. And Gideon is supposed to reject it. I mean, whether he was fully rejecting it or not. But the role of a shofet certainly is, you know, the powerful leader. Right? He lacks certain elements of melech. We talked about that specifically. The hereditary aspect of the melech is not usually there.
Have to hire these sleazy guys? Couldn't he have got the people of Shem to come with him and help him in this venture?
Right. So apparently not, right? Apparently not. He's got to get the gang, basically.
But what about diplomacy and expelling them from the land? Why just go and murder?
I think it's the most efficient. No, in all seriousness, I think it's the most efficient. This is the way to do it. So, a few things. First of all, the name Yerubal, we noted at the end of Parakhas, in Malbim, the idea that Yerubal is that he fought Baal, and that it's used there to show that people did not display proper gratitude. He fought the Baal for them, and he fought Midian for them, and here they didn't take care of his children. And that's one take. But I wonder, and I think I said this at the end of the previous parak, I wonder if this isn't a reversion of Yerubal to its original meaning, which was Baal fearing. Because it's Abimelech, son of Yerubal, and that's what the people of Shechem are going to identify with. He came from, before this whole thing of Gideon, and Gideon had an experience with a Malach and he frumed out and he doesn't want to go to the Baal anymore, and if anything he's attacking the Baal and he's not following his parents' ways. Now we go back to the old ways. Back in the good old days when everybody worshipped Baal.
But it also says Yotam being Rubal.
Sorry?
It also says the
Yotam,
The one that escapes is also...
Is also Yerubal, right.
He's going to be a good guy.
Right, but I think that the idea here is that it's sort of... The family has now gone back to what Yerubal originally meant, and whether Yotam is a Baal worshipper or not is not as much the point as the fact that the atmosphere is we've gone back to those days. That's the way I would look at it. I can't prove that I'm right. Although I will note that in Shmuel Bet, Yoav will rename... I brought it on number one. He renames Abimelech. Mihi ka es Abimelech ben Yerubeshet. Who struck Abimelech, the son of Yerubeshet? He calls him Yerubeshet. Beshet Boshet, shame. Right? Suggesting that Yerubal had been a positive reference, and he wants to make it a negative by converting it to Yerubeshet. Possible. So Abimelech, this fellow, invites everybody to Shechem, of all places, right? Shechem, again, is a bad place for us. It's not a good place. It's a place of violence and Hamas, and bad things happen in Shechem. He invites his maternal family, his mother's relatives, and he wants them to talk to the Baalei Shechem. I thought that the term Baal Shechem is an interesting term. We generally assume it means the landowners in Shechem, but before that, we talked about the Anshei Sukkot, for example, right? We talked about the Anshei Penuel. Baal seems like it connotes more mastery, unless it's just a play on words because, you know, they worship Baal, so let's call them Baal. The Dat Mikra I brought you, Professor Elitzur's introduction to the chapter in number two, he says, Anshei Shechem kulam miktsasam misyachsim al chamor avi Shechem hachivi. He says, you want to know who these people are? They're not Jewish. Not talking about Abimelech's family now, but the people he wants his family to talk to. He says, they are descendants of Hamor, the father of Shechem, as in, you know, that whole story back in the day, right, the kidnapping and rape of Dinah. These are the descendants. I didn't know they had descendants because Shimon and Levi did a pretty thorough job. Nonetheless, that's what he says, and he's not saying it randomly because in the Perek itself, we're going to see Abimelech draw on that image. He says the citizens of Shechem in that region are called Baalei Shechem in this chapter. Just like the residents of Yericho were called in Yoshua Baalei Yericho. These are landowners. These are people of status. So that's really interesting. Because Abimelech is appealing to the Baalei Shechem as his relatives in our story. He's referring to them as his relatives. And that's what leads you to wonder, maybe Gideon's Pilagesh was not Jewish from birth. That doesn't mean she didn't convert. Gideon, we say, is righteous. But it's worth noting that she may well have been from the locals originally. Okay. So he says, do you prefer me, or do you prefer the 70 sons? We've already talked about that. What's wrong with having 70 in power? When he says, what would you rather have, the 70 of them, or one of me? What's wrong with having 70?
People call to make decisions. People don't agree.
Right. So that Mikra says what Fred says, which is that you're never going to get anything done. Realistically, you're not going to be able to do anything. They're not going to be a good government. That's one possibility. I would tend to think there's another factor here, which is usually when someone was your governor back in the day, it meant that you were footing the bill for his whatever it was, whatever lifestyle he chose to pursue. Would you rather have bigger government or smaller government? Do you want 70 government salaries or do you want one government salary? And then there's the other passive fact of him saying, if he's saying this, I'm family and they're not.
Right, yeah.
So that's also relevant. So he has these family members, his uncles, donate to the campaign, right, to hire the mercenaries. It's a really interesting thing. The mercenaries are getting paid one coin per person they're going to kill. This is not a high-budget operation, right? I mean, I don't know how much one coin was, but that's all they're getting. It's not an expensive hit. Malvin, though, has a very interesting note on this collection. If you look at number three, he says, having them contribute to hire the hitmen made them partners in the enterprise. They helped him financially. This is a really important point. This is not a minor thing. This is a bit of strategy here. When you have people donate to the cause, that makes them shareholders. And that's going to help him going forward. So they get these people who are on Hashem Rekim Upochazin. People who are, as Rashi says, on this hasty people who don't think things through. Radak says they're rootless people who have no livelihood, and that's why they'll take the money to do this. Different explanations for it, but basically all of the same sense. And they come after Gideon's kids. Gideon's kids who are all there in one house. What do you mean? Why are they in one house? So we had the suggestion, maybe it was political. Take a look at Abarbanel, who offers two ideas, both of them stemming from the same assumption, which is that Abimelech did not let grass grow. Abimelech did this right after Gideon died. Ve'ulay hayunik batzim lehis ambel al avihem. They may have been gathered there for Shiva. They're mourning for their father. Or to decide, so how is succession going to work? This gives Abimelech an Esav aspect, right? Yikrevu yimei evel avi, right? He says soon he's going to be mourning for his father, and then he's going to get to go kill Yaakov. So Abimelech is living the dream. His father is dead, and now he's going to go after his brothers. But Yotam makes it out. Don't get high hopes from the fact that Yotam made it out. He's not going to save anybody. But nonetheless, he'll give us a good speech. So what we have here right now is already a sense of who Abimelech is. And that he's the anti-Gideon in the sense that he's campaigning for leadership, whereas Gideon, when approached, said, I don't want it. So that brings us to this next section here. And Yotam's speech, but actually before Yotam's speech, look at Pasuk Vav. Vayeasafu kol ba'alei Shechem v'chol beis Milo. All of these people, the ba'alei Shechem, get together, as well as beis Milo. Beis Milo is a small city that is near Shechem, according to Professor Elitzur. Vayelechu vayamlichu as Abimelech l'melech. And they crowned Abimelech as king. Not shofet, right? But king. Im Elon Mutzav Asher B'Shechem, by the Elon, which is in Shechem. Elon can be a big plain where there are trees, or it can be a specific tree. You could do it either way. But they crown Abimelech as king. King Abimelech. Rashi says the Elon is a big plain with monuments. Mutzav, like Matzeva, is monuments. I have to say that the view of Professor Elitzur, that it's a place with trees, makes a lot of sense because of where the story is going, because we're going to see a lot about trees in a moment. But they make him a king. That's interesting. It sounds like he's a king. He's certainly not treated as a king in halacha. Meaning, when they debate in halacha who the first king is, there's a lot of discussion about whether Moshe was a melech, whether Yeshua was a melech. No one ever considers Abimelech to be a king. There is an Alei Tamar on the Yerushalmi and Tan is sort of from here to see that a shofet can sort of be like a melech, but that's a hard sell. It really doesn't seem like he is a melech. If you take a look at Abarbanel in source number 5, he says, "Umasher oisha teidahu ki imayos sha'amar kan be'amlichu es Abimelech." He says, "What you have to know is that granted it says they crowned Abimelech king, he ne lefi ha'emes lo haya melech. He wasn't a king. V'lo mena'u imalcha Yisrael. He's not listed among our kings." This pasuk that he's referring to is in Teshuvah Beis. The pasuk is going to say Vayasar Abimelech al Yisrael. Vayasar is a term that means he exerted power. Regarding Yaakov, we say Vayasar el Malach. The idea of exerting authority, exerting power, doesn't mean he's king. Ki haya inyano memshala usrara. He had power. Lo malchus, but he wasn't king. V'zekia malchus lo se amer be'etzem ve'emes ki im kasher yesham mishicha. He says, first of all, the king is anointed. V'amelach ha'mishun shenimshach b'Yisrael haya Shaul. Shaul is the first one to get anointed. Aval nemar kana b'sefer shoftim kulo melech al tzara ha'avara l'chol shofet shoteru Moshe. He says the term melech doesn't mean king. It's a term that we use for anybody who has power over the community. Don't get hung up on it. That's basically Abarbanel's view, is, yeah, it says he's a king, but doesn't mean he's a king. There are pretensions to monarchy, and that we'll see more of, but that's about it. So Yotam sees that his half-brother, his murderous half-brother, has been crowned as potentate of some kind. So Pasuk Zayin, Ve'agidu li'Yotam, they told Yotam, Vayelech v'yamod v'rosh har gerizim. He goes to the top of Mount Gerizim. Vayisakolo, he raised his voice. Vayikra, and he called out. Vayomer lohem, and he said, Shimu elai ba'alei Shechem. Listen up, masters of Shechem. V'yishma alechem Elokim, and God is going to listen to you. Professor Eli Tzur says it's an expression of a shvua, it's an oath, by God. Haloch holchu etzim l'mshoach alehem melech. This is not where I expected him to go with his speech. Right? He starts up by saying, listen up, and God's going to listen. I would have expected a rant. Right? I would expect him to yell and scream. Maybe to cry for his brothers. To refer back to Gideon. That's not what he does. He says, let me tell you a story. The trees went to anoint a king. And they said to the olive tree, would you please rule over us? He says, am I going to stop producing my oil that is used to honor God and man? This is what we take Elohim there as a reference to Hashem. I'm going to go shake over the trees. Who, me? Nah, sorry. Go ask somebody else. And so the trees went to the fig. Rule over us. The fig says to them, what, am I going to leave my sweet fruit to go rule over, sway over the trees? And so they went to the grape. Rule over us. No one's going to like the tallest trees. You notice that? Like the fig tree is not a tall tree. The olive tree is not a tall tree. Now you're going to the grapevine. He says, am I going to give up my wine? My wine which gladdens, again, not sure to take Elohim here, and man. And I'm going to go sway over the trees. Am I going to do that? So the trees all said to the atad, to the thorn. All the trees got together and said to the thorn, Leich atam aloch aleinu, you go reign over us. Vayomer ha'atad al ha'itzim, and the thorn responds, Im be'emes atem boshchim osi l'melech aleichem, if you really are anointing me to be the king over you, bo'u chasu b'tzili, come take shelter in my shade. V'im ha'ayin, but if not, teitze eish min ha'atad v'sochal es arzei alavano, let fire go forth from the thorn and consume the cedars of Lebanon. I'm going to produce a fire that will destroy everything. End of parable. Before we get to the rest of Yotam's speech, impressions?
Hello.
What would you, what impressions do you have?
Mm-hmm. I'm just forget about the speech for a second. I'm just trying to understand. 69 of his brothers, 69 have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
He's now standing up in a hard regime and challenging the Baalei Shechem,
mm-hmm.
and telling them this is mashal. Where's his protection? Like, what's he doing here?
Well,
like, is it suicidal?
We don't know that he gets killed. So it could be, you know, he's doing this speech, figuring, let me finish this and then, you know, escape into the woods. But he doesn't get caught.
Okay.
I guess he knew what he was doing.
I assume there's significance about Har Gerizim?
So definitely have to ask the question of what exactly is the Har Gerizim issue here? Why are you mentioning Har Gerizim? We know Har Gerizim, right?
And where is that in relation to Shechem?
Right above.
It's right, yeah.
It's right above?
It's right there. But it's true. Har Gerizim is an important place for us. What happened on Har Gerizim?
The clock.
Close.
Bracha.
Bracha. Right? When you come into Israel, you give a blessing and a curse. Two mountains, Har Gerizim and Har Eval. Har Gerizim is the mountain of Bracha. Right? Then the Shomronim make it their home base. But we definitely have to talk about the role of Har Gerizim. But what, I mean, the whole thing is a strange parable. What exactly is the significance of the different kinds of trees? What's the message in them refusing the position of authority? What is this all about? So first of all, you have to see this comment in Mitzudat David, which would certainly offend the Malbim. Take a look at this line. I like this line. Mitzudat David in source number 6. Pasach devarav b'mashal. He began with a mashal. Ve'im she'en kol divrei ha'nimshal yidmu la'hamashal. He says, although not all the elements in the lesson are going to actually match the parable, hine k'tzas hadvarim yidmu, some of them match, v'yeser divrei ha'mashal, bo'u li'apos ha'mashal, and the rest of the elements of the parable are just there to make for a nice pretty allegory, u'lachnis b'lev ha'shomea, and so that, you know, it'll get into your heart. In other words, he says, don't get hung up on all the little ins and outs of this parable. Some of it's obvious, and the rest of it is just window dressing. That's his approach. It reminds me very much, I always like this, on Yonah. When in the last parak in Yonah, he has the kikayon grow, and he, you know, gets shade from it. And Ibn Ezra Radak, actually, has this very long discourse on what a kikayon is, and kik, and shem, and kik, and what kind of thing it is, and where it grows. And Ibn Ezra has this one line saying, it's a plant, leave it alone. not responding to Radak, he's earlier than Radak, but like, he says, this just doesn't matter, it's a plant. So that's Mitzudat David's approach here. He's like, don't get hung up on all the nuances. Nonetheless, we will. There are two basic ways to take this parable based on the various commentators. Approach number one is, you had good potential leaders among Gideon's kids. You had olives and figs and grapes among Gideon's kids. And you killed them in order to anoint the thorn. You didn't even ask them to rule over you and have them reject it. That's one school of thought. We'll see Radak fit this. We'll see Malbim fit this. The other school of thought is, kings are bad. The good trees refused to be king. They felt like there were more productive ways that they could spend their time. Kings are bad altogether. Not you had good potential ones, but the whole thing is a bad idea. And we'll see that in Rashi. First of all, they view that you killed the good ones. So Radak takes this view. If you take a look at number 7, Mashi's gir gimel etzim ela ledavar lekatser hadavar. It's a good point. He didn't mention 70 different kinds of trees. Right? This would have been a very long parak. They picked out 3, and you get the idea. V'od ki hizkir shlosha meshubachim, also mentioned the 3 greatest ones. V'yachar kach hizkir apachos, and then it went to the worst, shumashar l'Avimelech, which is the parable for Avimelech. So he's picking out the best ones, as Radak sees it. And Malbim, as is his way, expands further on how these are the best ones. He says in number 8, Miderach hamvakshim melech, levakesh ish hayoser ro'ui vayoser mi'uleh lemahalach shleimus haklal. He says, when you want a king, you go look for the king who is most appropriate, who is the greatest one, who's going to bring about the greatest perfection. That's what you go looking for when you look for a king. And he says, there are 3 goals that you have when you want to have a good king. Tov, you want a king who's good, meaning good, like of good character. A rave, somebody who's sweet, everybody likes him. And mo'il, one who's effective. That's what you're looking for, he says. We should, you know, bring this out before the campaigns. So he says, that's what you're fundamentally looking for. B'mos Gideon, when Gideon died, nimtzu ben banav chachamim dorshim hatov kishisilei zeisim. You had among his kids those who were smart and would seek the best, like the olive. Va'ashirim dorshim ha'arev kiteina chantafageha, and the wealthy ones who would look for that which is sweet, like the fig. And he quotes you from Shir Ashirim, the fig with the ripening fruit. And then some who are politically savvy, they would help you be effective. Kerem chemer anu lahem, which is from Yeshaya, the 27th parak in Yeshaya, they are declared to be the good grapes, the good vineyard. Ve'ela lo avu b'melucha v'lo shicharuha. But they didn't want to rule. They didn't seek it out. Ve'atem hamone am apchusim halachtem al ha'atad. So you guys, lowly people, went to the thorn. Shalonim tabaloto v'lore v'lo mo'il. 0 for 3. Right? Not good, not effective, not sweet. Rak mashaya kikos v'dardar lashchis ha'chav. The one who was like a thorn, who destroyed his family. That's the one you just selected as your king. The Abar Benel has a similar approach, although he has different labels for the kinds of good leader. But the same basic idea. And the fact that they refused it indicates that a good leader does not seek power. It's very interesting what Abar Benel does here. Abar Benel has a long digression. I didn't bring it. To quote Roman thinkers about leadership and about not wanting to lead. I brought you just the beginning of his comments in number 9, where he says, "Va'amar ocha bakashas hagedula humo face sichli she'enam vakesh ra'oi elaha." He says, looking for power is itself a sign that this guy is the wrong guy. Uchamram chachmei hamidos, as the scholars of character said, harodef acharas sara, sara barachas mimenu. You pursue power, power flees from you. Except that's not true for Rabbi Melech, right? He pursued power and he caught it. That's one school of thought. You could have had good leaders, and instead you went for the worst one possible. The second approach, though, is Rashi's approach based on the Medrash Tanhuma, and that is, kings are bad, they refused, you should have taken a hint. If you take a look at source number 10, this is the Medrash Tanhuma that Rashi is built on. He says, those three trees aren't just random trees. Those three trees are parallel to three rulers we've already met in Shoftim. Vayomru l'zayis, they said to the olive, ze osniel ben knaz, that's Osniel ben Knaz, the first Shofet. Shumi Shivtoshla Yehuda Shnemar Zayis Ra'anan. He is from the tribe of Yehuda, which is compared to the olive. Halchu Eitzel Devora. They went to Devora. Vayomer Eitzim Lateina. They said to the fig, Zeu Devora. That's Devora. To be honest, I'm not clear at all on the association of the fig with Devora, because Devora, right, sat under a date tree, not under a fig tree. So I think what he's saying here is that the Devora is the bee, which collects the sweet fruit. I think that's the image. Vayemruha Eitzim LaGefen, and the tree said to the grapevine, Zeb Barak VeGidon. That refers to Barak and Gidon. Why those? So it's because the Gidon is from Menashe, who is from Yosef. And we say for Yosef, Bein Paras Alei Ayin, which Onkelos says is like Gofen Dinitziv, like the grapevine. I didn't bring you the full medrash here with the whole root. But of those, when you think about those leaders, we don't know whether Osniel wanted power or didn't want power. That's not expressed in any clear way, except that he was given Chevron, and his wife was upset, right? Osniel ben Knaz is the one who marries Achsa, daughter of Kalev, and she's upset that they didn't get good land, and they didn't get good water, and she says, can I go ask for it? And he says, sure, go ahead. So maybe that's the idea there, is his refusal to look for land. But the other two, Devorah, we know, did not want it, right? She told Barak to go. Barak said no, and she said, fine, I'll go with you. And Gidon, we saw explicitly that he rejected it. So that's the message. Either kings are bad, look at all these great leaders, they all rejected power. Or alternatively, kings can be good, but you picked the wrong one. One of those is what Yotam is trying to say here. And he does it on Har Gerizim, the place of bracha, the place of blessing. So why would he choose this as his site? So Rav Hanan takes the simple approach in number 11. Halach v'yamod bahar. He went and stood on the mountain. He says, it's a good place for proclaiming words of Torah. And the Jews heard blessings and curses from that general site. The question, of course, you have to ask is, but Harival was where the curse was. Isn't this a curse kind of thing? So that's a little unsatisfying. But the Medrash Tanhuma, number 12, offers us another approach. This goes back to a Gemara in Sota on Daf Lamed Zayin, which has a lot of discussion about this. We have a problem in terms of where Shevet Levi stood. Those who were here when we did Yahushua will remember that it's not clear whether Shevet Levi is either on the ground in between the two mountains, looking up at each one, or whether they actually were on top of one of the mountains. And the Gemara in Sota has to try to resolve that problem. And it says that the Levim proclaimed the blessings and the curses toward each mountain, facing each mountain. That's the answer that the Gemara there gives. But this Medrash has a different view about how the brachos and klalos were done. It says, O sunshine, you omdin bahar eval umekalalin. Lemia you mekalalin. He says, the ones who stood on har eval and declared the curse, to whom did they curse? Lo le'elush omdin kinegdan. Not to the ones opposite them? Ve'elush mevarachin, and the ones giving the bracha on har grizim. Lemia you mevarachin. To whom did they issue the bracha? Lo le'elush kinegdan. Wasn't it to the ones opposite them? Nimsu ha'klalos ba'os al har grizim ba'brachos al har eval. He says, the bracha is declared on grizim, but it lands on, so to speak, the ones on har eval. The klala is declared on Har Eval, and it lands on the one on Har Grizim. So if you were on Har Grizim, right, somebody on Har Grizim received the curse. So that's why he goes up there to do it. Unlike that Gemara about how the blessings and curses went, clearly. But that's what this Medrash says. The symbolism is, this is the mountain where the curse was received. Okay. So he talks about the olive tree and how the oil honors Elohim va'anashim. So Mitzudat David says it honors Elohim va'anashim because we light the menorah with it. That's honoring God. And we anoint kings and kohanim with it. That's honoring man. That's one approach. Another approach found in the Targum is less focused on the Beis HaMikdash. It says we learn Torah by the light of the oil, the olive oil, and people pamper themselves with olive oil, and so that's the human part of it. Different approaches, different levels. But Radak says, no, that's not the way it works. I thought I brought it on here, but I see I did not. Radak says it's all one activity. He says lamps provide for God, and lamps provide for man. It's both. And he says, the mincha, the flour offering, which is mixed with oil in the Beis HaMikdash, is for God, but at the same time, it's eaten by people. So the same oil can actually do double duty. The same oil can be for God and for man. But did you notice the verb that was used in the mashal when they rejected being the leader, when they rejected the position of power? What did it say?
Lanua.
What is lanua?
Is that like to wave or something?
Mm-hmm. What does it mean here? So I like the Dan Mikra approach from Professor Eli Tzur. Meaning, the Malbim says that that it's to serve the needs of the people. Lanua means to go, you know, take care of them. But the Dan Mikra says, lanua is to move without productivity. It's really to shake. So that's the way that he reads it. There are a few nuances here. I don't know if people really want to get granular on this parable or want to go the Mitzudat David approach of it's a parable. Leave the details. But there are some things that are really interesting about the language. For example, if you notice the approach to the olive tree, when they approach the olive tree, they say, Malchalenu, rule over us. What do they say when they approach the fig? Before that. L'chi'at. Malchi aleinu. Go and rule over us. And then to the gefen, to the grapevine. Also, l'chi'at. Right? You go and rule over us. So Abarbanel and Malbim both tackle this. Abarbanel says that the olive tree has clarified that to be a king means you have to run around. Lanua. So when they approached the olive tree, they just said, rule over us. It's an easy gig. Sit on the throne and tell us what to do. Once the olive tree says, oh, no, that's not what being king is. You have to go places. You have to do things. So they approach the others by saying, go and be king. Now they understand that's part of the job. That's Abarbanel. Malbim says, it's because the olive tree was the only one that was really suited to be king. So for that, the olive tree, they said, rule. Once they start going to the others, they say, I know it's a stretch for you. L'chi, you have to go and work at it. The olive tree would have had it naturally. Okay.
If you translate Lanua the way that you have, then being a king is a negative.
Yeah. And that's why they say no. They say, this is a lot of work.
But I'm saying in general, in the whole mashal, it goes according to interpretation.
Yes, it goes with the idea that that's true. Right, I would agree with that. So, the wine gladdens the heart of God. Malbim notes it doesn't say anything about benefit when it comes to the fig. Right? With the olive tree, it said, I honor God and man. Right? The fig just says, I have my pleasure. It doesn't say about what it does for God and man. Because that's not what sweet fruit is about. It's just you enjoy it. But then the wine gladdens the heart of God and man. So the Gemara picks up on that one in source number 13. Minayin shein omrim shira, ela al hayayin. How do you know that there was no song in the service in the Beis HaMikdash unless wine was being poured on the Mizbeach? Shenemar, and he quotes our pasuk, v'chadalti es tiroshi ha-mesameach lokim ba'anashim. Im anashim mesameach lokim ba'amem mesameach. The Gemara asks, we know how wine gladdens people, right, when they drink. How does wine gladden God? And the answer is, because when you have a service involving wine, then they sing Shira. And that's that provides joy to God. And then Radak does something, which you have to be doing in your own head anyway, which is, what do you mean making God glad? God doesn't have emotions. What does it mean making God glad? So Radak picks up on that from Targum Yonatan. He says, Elohim is not God. He says, Yonasan Tirgame, Dimine Menasin Kadam Hashem Ube Chadon Rav Ravid, that we pour the libations before God from wine, and great ones are joyous. Great ones, not God. Hirchik Yonasan Hasimcha Me'abora Yisbarach Moshe Hirchik Kol Sha'ar Tara Mimenu. Yonasan did what Targumim do in general. Their Mea commentaries to the Torah that were used as educational tools 2,000 years ago were really, really careful not to anthropomorphize God. They wanted to stay away from the idea of giving God human traits. So that's why Yonasan doesn't want to say making God happy. It means making powerful people happy. Ein l'fanav lo simcha v'lo itzavon. God isn't happy and God isn't sad. U'mashnem rabo mehem aderach mashal. Whatever it does say about God is always a parable. Ki dibra Torah b'lashon b'nei adam. The Torah using the vernacular. And so he notes, we find that in Unkelus, when it says in the Torah b'is atzei ve'libo, that God was upset, Unkelus says, v'amar b'memrei l'misbar tukfehon kira usei, that God declared he would break their strength according to his will, leaving aside any sort of idea that God was upset. That's the way that the Aramaic commentators tend to do this, except when they don't. But that's what he says. Then they approach the thorn. And now it's all the people approaching the thorn. So Malbim comments on that in number 15, and he says, once the national leaders, the best of them, stop looking because all the good trees said no, Then everybody else says, "Well, we still want a king," and they approach the thorn, selecting the thorn to be their leader. The wise people didn't go after the thorn. Clear? Okay. Last bit within this parable. What's the association between the thorn and Avimelech?
He has no merit, positive traits, nothing.
That's one piece of it. He has nothing positive to offer. Mitzudat David Malbim note, he has no shade. Thorn bushes don't have good shade. What else, though? You're right, but there's one other piece. It's not just that he's unproductive, it's that he's dangerous. Right? Not only does he have nothing to offer, but he has bad things to offer. If you look at number 16, Radak, the king is selected to keep the nation from being harmed. When we call the varan, any bad thing, he is not suited for that purpose. He is harming them, the opposite of what was intended. Like the thorn that harms the person who holds on to it, Oyifalbo tries to work with it. And sure enough, that's what Avimelech is going to do to Shechem. And the people of Shechem are going to regret having appointed Avimelech before this story is over. So that's the parable. Yeah, Rob.
Do the people of Shechem really understand this motion?
Understand or accept?
I don't know. Why didn't he just speak in colloquialism?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's gonna give a follow up here. He isn't done. He's gonna be pretty clear about where he's going with this. But what's the usual goal of a parable? Like, why do people use allegories?
Teach you a lesson.
Be a little bit. I think it's a little more appealing to listen to than a harangue. You know, it's a story. Oh, the trees went to choose a leader. You know, and sometimes, because of the distance that it affords, it can help people to, you know, sort of recognize what's going on. Because it's not a frontal attack. The frontal attack coming. But I think he's, you know, trying unsuccessfully to appeal to them. How are you going to say?
If the Baal Shechem are not Jewish.
Which is a possibility, but we haven't proven it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then what is the point of them anointing a king? In other words, why would that affect the rest of Bnei Israel?
What do you think?
Well, one is I would think that he were Jewish, and that's why it does affect. But if he were Jewish, he has to have some army backing him up, which we haven't seen yet.
Correct. But I think, number one, they killed Gideon's kids. And by killing Gideon's kids, effectively, especially if Gideon really was in power and was setting up his kids as his heirs, it means they've cut off the local Jewish power structure, and this is what's left in place. In other words, the power behind Avimelech may not be Jewish, but there is no other power in this area. They will now be subject to Avimelech.
Okay, so you're limiting this to being local versus...
Right, so this is one of the major questions that we've struggled with in Sefer Shoftim as a whole. Right, Abarbanel has insisted that the Shoftim were federal. They're everywhere. But it's so hard to sustain that as you read the Sefer. You know, and even Devorah, who had a great reach, right, when you consider she's living off to the east and then she sends all these armies off to the west, even still, her theater of operations really is the north.
But you always had the statement with all of them that there was quiet in Israel for 40 years or whatever number of years. It doesn't say in their area, it says Israel.
You're right, and that supports Abarbanel's read. I'm not denying that there are pieces that will support a read that they are, you know, bigger. I mean, just the fact that we only hear about these suggests that, in fact, this is all there is. I've heard people want to claim that there are other Shoftim who aren't mentioned in the Sefer, but it's really hard to sustain, and it's certainly not what the Mefarshim believed. meaning Ralbag and Abarbanel, spent so much time, I mentioned this last week, trying to figure out the chronology and how long each one lived. And when we said there were 20 years, did it mean it includes the 7 years, it doesn't include the 7 years, and things like that. They're all assuming these are the consecutive shoftim. If you really believe that there were others who weren't named here, then I would look at it and say, well, maybe there are more years. Maybe there's something else going on in between one and the other. So that also supports the idea that they're federal. Because why couldn't you have, if they're really local, why couldn't you have one down in Yehuda and another one operating up in Naphtali? So I don't deny that there's evidence to support the idea that they're everywhere, but they don't sound like they're operating everywhere. And Avimelech is a perfect example.
Right.
He's not going anywhere. He's going to be in the area of Shechem his entire story. To think he ruled over Yehuda, from his place in Shechem, I don't see how he could. But I think that it matters to us because, he's just wiped out Gideon's line.
How long was he in power for? You're building a network. We have to be liberals in power now. I don't know. Next week it could be that they're out.
So you have a minimum of 3 years. We're going to see in sentence 22 that he is in power for 3 years. But keep in mind that you, during those 3 years, don't know when this ride is ending. And this is going to be a bloody and violent ride, and everyone's going to be waiting for it to end. But it's a 3-year ride. That's what we know of. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
So Yotam, as I said, isn't done. Let's take a look at the rest of what he has to say, starting in Pasuk Tetzai in sentence 16. Ve'ata, he says, and now, in Be'emes uv'samim asisem, if you have acted truthfully, if you have done properly, if what you did was good, and you crowned Avimelech as king, note that name, if you've done right with Yerubal and his household, remember you said to them they should lead, if what you did to him is what he deserved, my father fought for you. He put his life on the line. He saved you from Midian. It's direct enough, Rob. And now you rose up against my father's household. You killed his kids, all 70 of them on one stone. A phrase that the Gemara borrows, by the way. The Gemara in Gittin, when it talks about the murder by the Romans in Beitar, it talks about what they found on one stone. They're borrowing it from here. V'tamlichu es Avimelech ben Amaso al Baalei Shechem ki achichem hu. And instead, you put Avimelech, seriously, on the Baalei Shechem just because he's your brother? V'im be'emesu v'simim asisemim yubal v'im be'iso ayam hazeh. He reiterates, if what you did is right, simchu b'Avimelech, enjoy Avimelech. V'yismach gam hu b'chem, and he should enjoy you. V'im ayin, and if not, if what you did was wrong, this is a curse. May fire come from Avimelech and destroy the Baalei Shechem and destroy Beit Milo. And the fire come out from these places and destroy Avimelech. Vayanas Yosam by Yifrach, Vayelech Be'era, Yosam fled, went to Be'er, wherever that is. Vayeshiv Sham Ipnei Avimelech Achiv, and he stayed out of town. Stays away from Avimelech. So he says, you know you didn't deal properly. I mean, he's not really saying seriously, if what you did is good, then be happy. You didn't deal properly with Avimelech, and this is going to come back to bite you. Don't think that you're getting away with this. This story, and really going back to Perek Ches, going back to chapter 8, presents an anti-monarchy polemic. Which is interesting, because of course we're building towards monarchy in Sefer Shmuel. Like, that's where all this is going. But this is an anti-monarchy polemic. Gideon, righteous Gideon, refuses it, or refuses to claim it for himself. The righteous trees don't want to reign. Abimelech wants it, and he is a corrupt and bloody person. And Yotam's mashal, as read by Rashi in the Medrash, is that worthy people don't want to be king. And unworthy people pursue it to the detriment of society. So this is anti-Malchus, despite the fact, again, that in Sefer Shmuel, we're going to find out that that may be the best system we have. The people are going to ask for it. God's not going to be so thrilled. We have to talk about that, God willing, when we get there. But this, at this point, if you were to stop me in Tanakh here and say, monarchy, good or bad? I'd say bad. Right? That seems to be where things are. So I think that's a good spot, because the next piece is really going to be a different story. It's going to be the first rebellion against Abimelech. So that's coming up in the next episode.